3341 Southeast Belmont Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Ooh, the bigger.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor, Plaid Tidings. Produced by Enlightened Theatrics, the play runs from November 23rd to December 11th at Salem's Historic Grand Theater. Enlightened Theatrics provides professional musical theater experiences and theatrical education. Plaid Tidings is a special holiday edition of Forever Plaid, a musical homage to the Close Harmony guy groups that reached the height of their popularity during the 1950s. Again, that's Plaid Tidings, produced by Enlightened Theatrics from November 23rd to December 11th at Salem's Historic Grand Theater, 191 High Street, Northeast in Salem. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's about 5 p.m., and KBOO Evening News is coming up next. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the downtown Portland homeless camp Right to Dream 2 may be facing eviction.
The Portland City Council holds its final vote tomorrow on whether to prohibit new fossil fuel terminals and limit existing ones.
And Oregon and Southwest Washington residents should prepare for snow, freezing rain, sleet, and winds tomorrow, as the National Weather Service has issued a winter storm watch.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 7th, 2016. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Mayor Charlie Hales has questioned the credibility and impartiality of the U.S. District Court Judge Michael Simon. Hales wants to appeal the judge's order that Portland city attorneys must return to his courtroom in January to explain how they're going to comply with the requirement that the city implement a community oversight and advisory board. The mayor objected to any additional court appearances beyond the annual hearings that are required in the agreement. The most recent Justice Department review pointed out that Portland was out of compliance with the 2012 settlement agreement between the Portland Police Bureau and the U.S. Justice Department. That agreement resulted from a federal investigation that the Portland Police Bureau had used excessive force against people with mental illness. City attorneys also criticized the judge for allowing courtroom spectators to subject city attorneys and officials to, quote, racist and sexist attacks during the last annual hearing on October 25th. Local activists have raised concerns that the legal challenge would slow down implementation of the oversight board, but city commissioners stated that the city was not challenging the terms of the agreement, just the judge's authority to require additional court appearances.
On Thursday, the Portland City Council will vote on an ordinance to prohibit new bulk fossil fuel terminals or the expansion of existing terminals. The ordinance is a follow-up to last year's municipal resolution to the same effect. KBOO's Ray Bodwell spoke with Jasmine Zimmer Stuckey, the senior organizer with the Columbia Riverkeepers, about the coming vote.
We're an environmental group that works to protect and restore the Columbia River and all life connected to it. And a major focus of ours right now is the proposed fossil fuel export terminals on the threatening the lower Columbia River.
Jasmine, about a year ago, November of 2015, the City Council passed a resolution minimizing or eliminating any future expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure in Portland. Maybe you could give our listeners a little bit more detail about what that entailed and what is going to happen going forward.
So that resolution was an amazing resolution to ban fossil fuel infrastructure expansion in Portland. It was just a resolution, a statement of a guiding principle. And tomorrow at 2 p.m. at City Hall, Portland City Council is actually going to vote on the binding policy to implement that resolution. So we're going from a thought, an idea, a vision to the policy that we need to implement to move forward with this great idea.
There was a fairly lengthy review period leading up to this and an opportunity for citizen comments.
Yes. I mean, in the past year, Portlanders have been incredibly engaged to make sure that this project stays on track and stays true to its initial vision.
And this is fairly unique in the U.S., isn't it? Isn't Portland one of the first to take this step?
Yes. Portland is leading the way, you know, paving the future for a lower carbon, more sustainable economy, more sustainable cities. And I think that other cities across America are looking at Portland to make sure that this is something that they can also replicate. As we, you know, listeners probably know, you know, solutions don't come from Washington, D.C. Solutions come from communities. And this is an example of a solution coming from communities.
Do you have a high level of confidence that this will pass and become actual ordinance?
The city has been very committed to this. They've heard thousands and thousands of citizens speak in favor of this. They've gone through multiple draft resolutions. There's been multiple public hearings where they've heard from their constituents. And I'm confident that tomorrow we'll have an outcome that we can all be proud of. One of the reasons why I'm particularly excited about this resolution is it's great for the public, because instead of focusing on what we don't want. We don't want coal export terminals. We don't want oil export terminals. Those are all going to be essentially banned under this new policy. So we get to focus our energy on what we do want. And so all of the energy that we've used in the past couple of years fighting these major fossil fuel infrastructure proposals, you know, we can pivot that energy to collaborate, you know, with the city and with innovators to actually create the city that we want to live in, as opposed to defend the city that we don't want to live in. And so I think that's really great. The other thing I'll mention is there's a couple other things that the city's going to consider tomorrow. One is on inclusionary zoning. So after they vote on the fossil fuel ban, the city will begin a conversation about affordable housing in Portland. So if folks want to come to the City Hall tomorrow and witness the historic fossil fuel vote at 2 p.m. down at City Hall, you're welcome to do that. And then if you'd like to stick around and be part of the conversation about affordable housing, that's more than welcome too.
Jasmine, thank you so much for your comments. For KBOO, I'm Ray Bodwell.
As the climate change debate continues in Congress, young environmental activists are taking action into their own hands. Climate Connections brings us this story about a 12-year-old boy in Michigan who's advocating for polar bears.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. 12-year-old Bryce Mader is out to save polar bears by using art to teach kids about global warming's impacts on the Arctic. He was inspired to take action after learning about climate change in school in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
I went home, Googled it, and found out like all this tons and tons of information. And that's what inspired me to create Polar Army.
Polar Army is Bryce's nonprofit. It features a website where kids can upload climate-related artwork and learn how to cut emissions. He also gives talks to inspire other kids at schools, churches, and fairs across Western Michigan.
A lot of kids at the end of the presentation raise their hand and say, "How can I do what you're doing?"
Bryce's plans for Polar Army include developing a curriculum and a youth ambassadors program to expand awareness. He says action is needed now because climate change is so urgent.
This is something not like happening like 50 years from now. It's happening right now. And we need to do something to help save the polar bears.
He may soon get to see those polar bears in person. His family plans to visit northern Canada next year, a trip that will likely reinforce his commitment to climate action. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The downtown Portland homeless camp Right to Dream 2, known locally as R2D2, may be facing eviction. The property's landlord, Michael Wright, has informed the camp of his intentions to evict the camp and is drawing up papers to do so. Wright stated that he is unable to meet his contractual agreements while R2D2 remains on his property. Considered by many to be a model example of homeless communities, the camp has been on the corner of Northwest 4th Avenue in Burnside for the past 5 years. The city has tried to find a new home for the camp a number of times without success. The latest attempt occurred last October when the city tried to move it to Southeast Portland, but was told it would violate city zoning codes.
Get ready for serious weather coming this Thursday. The National Weather Service has issued a wind advisory and winter storm watch for tomorrow. Residents in northwest Oregon and southwest Washington should be prepared for snow, freezing rain, and sleet throughout the day. The wind advisory takes effect beginning this afternoon with gusts forecast up to 55 miles per hour in the Portland metro area, with the strongest winds blowing through Thursday morning. Motorists and cyclists should take caution when crossing north-south running bridges like the I-5 corridor along the Columbia. Those in need of shelter in the Portland metro area can call 211 for more information.
Climate justice is an important topic for those who believe in science and to the communities who are impacted the most by environmental inequities. Locally, the Coalition of Communities of Color is addressing these issues directly by offering free workshops to teach communities of color and low-income communities how they can take a lead in finding equitable environmental solutions. Here to tell us more about their upcoming workshop, postponed due to bad weather, but still slated to happen, is Environmental Justice Manager for the Coalition of Communities of Color, Maggie Talmadge, and Shilpa Joshi, Organizing Director for Renew Oregon. Thanks for joining us, Maggie and Shilpa.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So to get started, why don't we have you, Maggie, tell us a bit about the Coalition of Communities of Color and who makes up the CCC.
Thank you. So the CCC is an alliance of culturally specific community-based organizations with representation from the following communities: African, African American, Asian Pacific Islander, Latino, Native American, and Slavic. The CCC supports a racial justice effort to improve outcomes in our communities. So that's through leadership development, through culturally appropriate data and research, through policy analysis and advocacy, and simply coalition building.
All right, well, how about Renew Oregon? Shilpa, give us the rundown of what you guys are doing.
Great. So Renew Oregon is a campaign to pass big climate policy at the state level in the state of Oregon. It was established about 2 years ago by other major environmental groups as a new place for non-traditional and unique actors to engage on these discussions on what policy looks like to build a better world and bring more equitable climate solutions for Oregon. So we work with labor unions, communities of color, the mainstream environmental groups, a lot of grassroots organizers across the state, climate-impacted industries like wineries and outdoor rec industry, tribes, rural organizers, low-income advocates. We're really trying to build policy that addresses this really big problem that impacts all layers of society, which is climate change, with really big, exciting solutions.
So, Coalition of Communities of Color and Renew Oregon, how did these two organizations find each other?
I think that Coalition of Communities of Color is a really powerhouse and really necessary piece of the advocacy and organizing landscape in the state of Oregon, based in the Portland area and now expanding across the state. Renew Oregon knew that we wanted to build a strong partnership as a foray into building more and more ties with equity and community of color serving groups. So,
and we also recognize, right, and I think we see this reflected in the local, state, and national election, is the progressive agenda needs to be one agenda, and we can no longer win on climate, on corporate taxes, on anything if we don't band together.
Let's talk about the relationship between climate justice and communities of color or low-income communities. How are these communities adversely affected and perhaps uniquely adversely affected by issues like climate change?
Well, I think Shilpa started to address that as well. I mean, we know climate change affects everyone, but communities of color, low-income communities, are hit first and worst, both by climate change and the pollution that causes it. You know, we know who's most impacted, those who are already suffering great disparities, whether that's access to food, ability to weatherize one's home, ability to pay for transportation, and an income able to weather changes due to climate change.
Yeah, what I'd also add to that is I think in the way that we see economic winners and economic losers panning out over history, it's along those lines that you're also seeing who's suffering the most from climate change. In the global north, as we consider Europe and North America, I think most people know that these countries have contributed the most to greenhouse gas pollution and in turn have contributed most to the impacts of climate change as we're seeing them. But the impacts are being felt first and worst in the global south, with sea level rise, with drought conditions that are causing mass disruption to food availability, to clean water availability. And all of those compounding negative impacts are hitting communities that are low income and that are rural and that are communities of color first.
And I think also as we look at solutions to climate change, communities of color, low-income communities, refugees, immigrants, farm day laborers are historically have not been at the table, right? And our interests have not been looked out for. So we're not at the table to craft a policy that actually looks out for our communities.
Well, just today, President-elect Trump announced Scott Pruitt, a known climate skeptic, as his pick to head the Environmental Protection Agency. So does this pose a concern to communities of color?
Of course. We're looking at Trump's election and his entire cabinet of curiosities as a threat. Right? Our communities are reorganizing, we're re-strategizing, we're reprioritizing in order to deal defensively on a lot of fronts for the next 4 years.
And I just want to, something that we were talking about earlier today also, but what Maggie touched on with the progressive agenda needing to work together in order to put up the strongest front and get we're going to be hit really hard in a lot of places, and I think the most vulnerable Oregonians, whether low income or rural or communities of color, are going to be hit hardest and worst. And I think it's our responsibility as advocates to not silo ourselves. If I'm working on climate, then I only care about climate. I'm only going to go to Salem and talk to legislators about climate. I don't think that that hasn't been the way that we've been operating, but it definitely can't also be the way we have to move forward together. So I'm seeing a great responsibility with environmental groups across Portland and across the state to really throw down on progressive issues and priorities that are on healthcare, on education, on protecting basic food needs like stamps and ABT, while we're also asking our progressive partners in the communities of color groups to come and work with us on climate.
And one of the ways your two organizations are circling the wagons around this is through workshops. Back in October, you held your first workshop on climate justice. I'm curious what inspired the beginning of these workshops and where they're headed.
Yeah, so back in 2013, the Coalition of Communities of Color made its first explicit environmental goals. Recognizing that environmental initiatives can serve traditional social service, community development, and anti-poverty strategies. We've been developing a relationship with a lot of the organizations within Renew Oregon since. and when we got more involved with Renew Oregon, we recognized that our communities are decades behind in terms of resourcing to be at the table, to be active on climate. So first and foremost, we need to just start with where our communities are and engage them, starting there and connecting existing priorities and needs to climate and environmental initiatives. And this is a way for us to bring together community and honestly get their expertise on developing policies.
And how is Renew Oregon involved in these workshops?
We've been working with APANO and CCC and staffers at other community of color serving groups to just provide support. I've run workshops like this at previous jobs as a climate organizer. So bringing that expertise and really I've I've learned so much. I mean, it's a collaborative process, and we've really built this thing that's greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah. And I think these workshops, right, and as we work on any issue, in order to have a really strong social movement, both on environmental or climate justice, we need to focus on building power within our communities of color and low-income communities. So that's the first start, and that's bringing awareness to our communities.
So you did have a second workshop scheduled for tomorrow titled Climate Justice Workshop, Crafting Solutions and Stories. That is going to be postponed due to inclement weather, but when it is rescheduled, what are you going to be talking about?
So the first of the two-part series focused on talking about climate change, climate impacts, and how they're felt, how members have in that workshop really have felt them and seen them in their own communities. So really making that personal connection to the issue. And then this one really throws down on the skills needed to engage with legislators. So what are the policies that are currently that we're thinking about? How does their personal experience and their story play a big part in how we talk to legislators about this? And so giving them the skills to craft their own story, and then the logistical skills of how to meet with legislators. And
great. And we're just about out of time. So how can listeners learn more about your organizations?
Please go to our website. It's coalitioncommunitiescolor.org. My email, it's just maggie@coalitioncommunitiescolor.org. Take a look at our events page. Sign up for our newsletter. Give me an email or shoot me an email.
And you can go to Renew Oregon as well. But
great. We've been talking with Maggie Talmadge, Environmental Justice Manager for the Coalition of Communities of Color, and Shilpa Yoshi, Organizing Director for Renew Oregon. The free workshop to be scheduled at a to-be-announced date is called Climate Justice Workshop, Crafting Solutions and Stories. To find out more about the CCC, once again, go to their website at coalitioncommunitiescolor.org. To learn more about Renew Oregon, find their website at reneworegon.org. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you listened to the KBOO Evening News yesterday, you heard us speaking with Hillary Shahani of Pacific Rivers, who right now is leading a large group of people to testify at a hearing held by the Army Corps of Engineers at the Oregon Convention Center on whether to breach four dams on the Snake River. The four Snake River dams are considered one of the biggest contributing factors to the decline of Pacific Northwest salmon and steelhead. The waters they hold back contain some of the best fish habitat and migration channels in the Northwest. But the Northwest fish are not the only animals threatened by these dams. The reduction in salmon is causing starvation for orcas in the Puget Sound due to not enough salmon to eat. KBOO's Chris Andre interviewed Michelle Seidelman of Sea Shepherd's Orcas, whose group is fighting to save the orcas, on her morning show Air Cascadia today, and we have an excerpt from that conversation.
So basically, right now, the Columbia River System operations is allowing the public in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana to come in and make a public comment on removing the lower four of the Snake River dams. This is absolutely critical for salmon and steelhead habitat, who are now listed on the endangered species list. So then the southern resident orcas, which consist of JK and L pod, they are down to numbers of 80. And just this summer, we watched Polaris slowly starve to death, as well as her son, Dipper. And all the while, his sister, she was constantly trying, J46, his sister, Star, was consistently trying to bring salmon, forage for his mother, forage for her son, and bring salmon and feed them. And actually, when Dipper passed, he was covered in teeth marks from her trying desperately to keep his head above the water as he starved to death. And unfortunately, she lost that battle, and she lost both of her brother and her mother. And now I actually saw pictures yesterday sent out to me with now her showing signs of clear starvation. So we've got to breach those dams. We cannot wait for a five-year, the NEPA five-year plan will kill our orcas. They will be extinct by then. There was already a seven-year, three, $33 million study done by the EPA, and it says breach the dams. It's the number one way to bring salmon back, and we need to breach them now. And that's what I'm trying to get the public to realize, that the five-year study is too late for salmon, too late for the southern resident orcas.
How do we roll back the NEPA plan?
We can do it by executive order. You can call Obama today, and it actually, these are taxpayer dams. They aren't owned by Bonneville Power. They are not private, and they could be signed by Obama today, and we could start breaching, possibly, hopefully, before Trump takes office.
That was Michelle Seidelman of Sea Shepherd Orcas telling us how to effect action to breach the Snake River dams and save the Pacific orca, as well as salmon and steelhead. She was speaking on KBOO's Air Cascadia this morning. To testify or witness the Army Corps of Engineers hearing on breaching the Snake River dams, you can go over to the Oregon Convention Center right now. The hearing goes on from now until 7 o'clock.
Work is continuing to reconnect one of California's longest rivers to the Pacific Ocean. Dams and levees built in the early 20th century have kept the San Joaquin River in the Central Valley from flowing into its natural delta year-round. But a landmark decision in federal court more than a decade ago has forced state and federal agencies to partner with farmers, cities, and environmentalists to craft a way to restore the river and its wild salmon run. Free Speech Radio News' Vic Bedouin explains.
Restoring the San Joaquin River is the most ambitious endeavor of its kind in the nation. Since the Fryant Dam was built in the 1940s, most of the river water captured has been used by farms and cities along the east side of the agricultural Central Valley, and the river often dries up just 50 miles downstream from the dam. The San Joaquin once had one of the largest salmon runs in the state that formed a biological chain between the Pacific Ocean and California's fertile interior. At a state fish hatchery just below Fryant Dam, biologists from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife are working hard to bring the fish back. Biologist Gerald Hattler explains how.
What we can do here is we can take a very small number of fish. We will bring them here either as eggs or juveniles. We raise them up until they're sexually mature, which is approximately 3 years, and we'll spawn them here at the facility, and then their offspring will go into the San Joaquin River.
Much of this work was sparked by a landmark 2006 settlement between the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, California resource agencies, and environmental groups that had sued to force the government to restore the river. Elizabeth Vasquez of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation says already there's been progress.
We actually got to reconnect the river this year. It's the first time since 2011 that water's flowing from Fryant Dam all the way down the upper river to the confluence through the Merced all the way to the ocean.
It's a massive, complex undertaking. Restoring the continual river flow will impact farmers downstream who draw water from the river and aquifers to irrigate crops. And here's where there's potential conflict. In order to accommodate salmon runs, it will be necessary to build a bypass channel for fish to swim around at least one reservoir that serves farms. In other places, river channels and levees would need to be reconstructed, says Vasquez.
We have to basically build the river from the ground up. So we have to work with our neighbors, the farmers that are adjacent to the San Joaquin River that have started to farm closer to the levees that would be affected by flow going back to the river. We've got to look at the levees themselves to make sure that they're capable enough to pass our flow. And we've got to actually work with the entities taking water off of the river for their agricultural interests.
Over the past 70 years, San Joaquin River water has been critical not only to farms, but also cities up and down California's Central Valley. But enough water to restore fish habitat could mean reducing water for humans downstream by nearly a fifth. The water interests of towns and farms are represented by the Fryant Water Authority. Jason Phillips is chief executive officer. He says the project is 5 years behind schedule.
There's been incremental progress, and I think for some of the selling parties, that's a really good thing. But at this point, as I look at it, the challenges are greater than we know how to solve right now.
One of those challenges rose up in 2009 when water flows were released downriver to test the system. In the decades-long absence of a flowing river, some farmers have planted crops close by or even in the river bottom. Restored flows could damage those crops. Phillips describes what ensued.
What happened was more seepage started occurring into the adjacent farmlands than what was envisioned in the settlement itself. And because of that, the Bureau of Reclamation had to start making adjustments to the construction plans.
It will take a lot of political will to move the project forward. The overall goal remains 2029 at a projected cost of $1.6 billion. Only a fraction has been allocated and spent to date. That's not helped by opposition from local figures who don't agree with the spending priorities. Then there's the drought, which makes diverting water from farms and towns even more difficult. But river restoration advocates counter that the benefits are overlooked. These include flood control, replenished aquifers for future water supply, and recreation for the public to enjoy at the river. Already there are hopeful signs. Some 50,000 Chinook fingerlings were released into the San Joaquin last spring, and this year that number should triple with more hatcheries planned. But releasing juvenile salmon will do little for the ecosystem if they can't make it to the Pacific and back to spawn. But if they do, the San Joaquin River Restoration Program would prove itself a model for restoring dam-choked rivers elsewhere in the nation and beyond. Vic Bedoyan, FSRN, Fryant, California.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for news from the BOO at 5:45, followed by Kitchen Table Conversations at 6. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be stormy and windy with a high of 33 and a low of 31. East of the Cascades and Hood River, skies will also be stormy, and you can expect 5 to 8 inches of snow there. Today in history, in 1869, Jesse James committed his first bank robbery. The robbery took place in Gallatin, Missouri, at the Davis County Savings Association. In his haste, Jesse James grabbed a stack of bank paper instead of cash, making his first bank robbery an unprofitable one. Our quote of the day comes from Jesse James himself, who said, "Surrender had played out for good with me."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. National Nurses United will join Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Chuck Schumer, and other supporters of Medicare and Social Security in Washington, D.C. Wednesday to demand hands-off Medicare and Social Security. They will deliver a petition opposing cuts to these vital programs. Martha Kuhl is an RN and Secretary Treasurer of National Nurses United.
The petition we are going to present is a petition that has over 1 million signatures on it demanding that Trump, Ryan, and Mitch McConnell keep their hands off of our Medicare and our Social Security benefits. Medicare and Social Security are very popular programs, and prior attempts to undo them, privatize them, take them away, have met with great resistance, and this is part of that resistance. Nobody believes that Trump's election means that we should no longer have Medicare or Social Security.
Kuhl says that National Nurses United are staunchly opposed to Paul Ryan's schemes to destroy these vital and beloved programs.
Because we are nurses on the front line and caring for patients daily, we really see the effects of the current income inequality in our society, and preserving basic human rights and basic social programs is important for all of us.
Organizing is the key right now. We can't lay down and say it's all over. There's enough fighting spirit in here. Yes, people have shocked, and they've been shocked because of these results. But it's time to move on. It's time to remember that there's still a fight, there's still a campaign, there's still workers who need help.
Dan Duncan is president of the Northern Virginia Labor Federation. He says workers committed to fighting for a better future need to stay active and get as many other workers as possible to stay active to keep fighting for better working conditions, higher wages, and the right to organize unions. Duncan says while today's workforce is very different from the manufacturing-based centers of union power in the 1950s and 60s, workers are still workers. The 21st century workforce still needs organized power to stop employer exploitation, and they need to join the labor movement.
There's a new model of workers taking place in this country, and they need protection just as much as the factory workers of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s did. We've got to look at the new worker society. We've got to look how they're being exploited by people who are trying to use them to make money, just to chew them up and spit them out, and we've got to find ways for them to become part of the labor movement.
Brought to you by the California Teachers Association, 325,000 educators who know quality public schools make a better California for all of us. Information on how California teachers are shaping a stronger future for our kids is online at cta.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Earlier this year, Wells Fargo came under fire from Congress and the public for opening bogus bank accounts for thousands of unsuspecting customers. As many as 2 million sham accounts have been created by representatives who were under intense pressure to make new sales. The admission of fraud ultimately cost former CEO John Stumpf his job and a large chunk of his compensation. Since then, senior Wells Fargo executives have repeatedly promised to do the right thing for the thousands of customers who had had the accounts opened without their knowledge. New CEO Timothy Sloan even said that his first priority was to restore trust in Wells Fargo. But their public position has not aligned with their behavior. According to the New York Times, the bank has been trying to kill lawsuits filed by customers by moving the cases out of court and into private arbitration. Arbitration is a secretive legal process that prohibits class action suits and often favors the corporations who call for it. The bank claims that the arbitration clauses in the legitimate agreements that customers signed up for when they opened their initial accounts also cover disputes related to the false accounts that were set up without their knowledge. Apparently, some judges have agreed with this argument, but lawmakers are understandably outraged. Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown has introduced a bill last week that would prevent Wells Fargo from forcing arbitration in the bogus account cases.
While many people endure holiday stress, this month we're at least rewarded with the ability to enjoy delicious food and celebrations. That isn't always the case for thousands of Oregonians living with Crohn's disease or colitis. KBOO reporter Demi Hellenius, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, has more.
It's called the invisible disease, but for thousands of people who have Crohn's disease or colitis in Oregon, they'll tell you it is anything but. These inflammatory bowel diseases that cause pain, weight loss, exhaustion, and other symptoms that are not curable. Jordan Sorrells has had Crohn's for 20 years and says it's a challenge to educate people around him about the disease, simply because some of the symptoms are unpleasant and hard to discuss.
It's definitely one of those diseases that people don't want to talk about. It's not polite dinner conversation. Things that I've had to deal with over the years, the main things that I deal with are fatigue, weight loss, and they just depend on my stress level and everything that's going on.
This week is Crohn's and Colitis Awareness Week. The causes of Crohn's disease or colitis are not well understood, but diet and stress are known to aggravate symptoms. Those symptoms include persistent diarrhea, rectal bleeding, abdominal cramps, fever, weight loss, and night sweats. Christina Humble with the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America says it's likely you know someone who has inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD, and don't even realize it.
I think it's just watching what you say, because things that they don't like to hear is like, do you have an eating disorder? Or a lot of people think you don't look sick, but you really are, because it's internal. It's not outside.
Sorrell says if you think you have symptoms of IBD, it's important to see a doctor, since treatments can help you live with the disease.
Crohn's and colitis have so many varying symptoms, and they can change from person to person. It's so individualized that if you think you have any symptoms that relate to fatigue, weight loss, diarrhea, constipation, running to the bathroom, having upset stomachs. If something seems off, just go see a doctor and ask questions.
According to the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America, as many as 70,000 new cases of IBD are diagnosed in the U.S. each year, with as many as 80,000 children living with the condition. For KBOO News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
Thousands of migrating snow geese have died as a result of landing in the toxic waters of a flooded, abandoned copper mine in Butte, Montana. The birds were on their way from Canada to the southwest United States on November 28th when they encountered a storm that forced roughly 10,000 of them into the Berkeley Pit. The pit's water contains concentrated amounts of arsenic, cadmium, cobalt, copper, iron, and zinc, and is acidic enough to melt metal. A spokesperson for the mining company, Montana Resources, which jointly manages the pit with the Atlantic Richfield Company, said workers did everything they could to scare off the birds. The implementation of hazing techniques using spotlights and noisemakers became mandatory when 342 dead snow geese were found floating in the pit in November of 1995. Autopsies on each of those birds found burns and festering sores lining their oral cavities, trachea, and esophagus, as well as digestive organs. Officials expect the toll to grow since deaths are not instantaneous. Dead birds have been found on roadsides outside of Butte recently. The Environmental Protection Agency says the companies managing the pit will be fined if their hazing techniques are found to not be in compliance with regulatory standards.
With blizzard conditions pummeling the Standing Rock Sioux and their many allies camped in North Dakota, and with the Army Corps' decision to reroute the Dakota Access Pipeline in their frozen pockets, the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux told the protesters to go home. "We got it," said the Sioux chairman David Archambault II in his letter yesterday to the protesters known as Water Protectors. "This decision is everything we had asked for, a non-granting of the easement, initiating an environmental impact study, and the suggestion of a reroute." That's a quote from Archambault, who was referring to Sunday's announcement by the Corps that they would not approve the construction permits for the pipeline. The decision, announced to loud cheers in the Sioux Lakota camps near Standing Rock, halts construction of the 3.8 billion mile Dakota Access Pipeline, billion dollar. "It's a significant victory for the tribes, but they are viewing it with caution. It is assumed that the Corps' decision was prompted by the Obama administration and presumed President-elect Donald Trump, who said he wants a pipeline to be completed as planned. The pipeline's builder, Energy Transfer Partners, has also vowed to fight in court and complete the pipeline. State and local authorities in North Dakota have been highly supportive, but Archambault is optimistic that Energy Transfer Partners will have difficulties trying to undo the decision. He noted that Energy Transfer Partners cannot cross the easement. Archambault pointed out that, quote, "not only will they jeopardize the entire pipeline project, but they will also jeopardize their investors' money and their bank loans. The next stage will be focused on the legal battles," end quote. The indigenous tribes have relied on their belief in nonviolent protest and prayer. Camps like the Red Warrior Camp on State Highway 1806 were aromatic with sage and perpetually filled with drums and chanting when the Corps' announcement was made, said Archambault. "Now you must believe in your prayer."
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, Joe Leno, and Jenna Yokoyama. The producer is Dale Burke. Special thanks to Climate Connections and Labor Radio. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Voices from the Edge with host Joanne Hardesty, progressive talk radio with a grassroots perspective. At 9, it's Press Watch, your weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program hosted by Teresa Mitchell. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. At 11 on Between the Covers, welcome author Emma Donahue to discuss her critically acclaimed new book, The Wonder. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, you will be brought conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. A reminder that all new and increased gifts to KABU are matched one-to-one through the end of the year. Thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Go to KABU.fm and click on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KABU with news from your community radio station.
This is Erin Yankee. I'm here today on News from the Boo, where we talk about things that are going on at KABU. And today we're not going to exactly talk about things going on at KABU because we have our 2016 Artist in Residence, Lou Watson, with us.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! And we're going to talk about the event and presentation of the Artist in Residence project that's actually happening this Sunday out at Jubit's Truck Stop. So, hi, Lou.
Hi, Erin.
So, first of all, maybe let's just talk about Sunday and the project and the movie and what you're actually going to be showing, and then we can kind of work backwards.
Well, on Sunday at 2 o'clock at the Jubit's Truck and Travel Center, there is going to be, I would say it's more of a performance slash lecture slash motivational speaking slash PowerPoint, and it's going to be how to score the I-5, and it's going to be a how-to for everybody for their journeys on how to turn those into a musical adventure. So we'll have some instruction for that, and there's going to be a quiz, I-5 quiz, and interesting fact section. There's going to be a few musical interludes, and then there's going to be the presentation of the 15-minute film, which is Traveling the I-5 for Choir and Triangle. And that's the project I've been working with KABU with for the last 6 months. Oh, man, 6 months.
Let's break down what you mean by scoring the I-5.
Well, I've been making work for the last few years where